And now, VOA's International Edition. Coming up, typhoon hits eastern Philippines, Syria accusing Israel of launching airstrikes on its territory, plus outgoing U.S. Defense Chief making a final visit to Afghanistan. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Typhoon Hagupit has killed at least two. It happened in the Philippines after making landfall on the eastern coast. A local weather agency said Sunday the storm crashed into remote fishing communities of Samar Island, tearing roofs off buildings and sending them flying into the Pacific Ocean. Power is out through the region, and roads are covered with trees, and tin roofs are strewn everywhere. Massive storm had winds as high as 210 kilometers per hour. VOA's Brian Patton reporting now from the centrally located island of Cebu, which received relatively little battering from the storm.
While this typhoon is not as strong as last year's Typhoon Haiyan that left more than 7,300 people dead or missing, it is still causing significant damage to impoverished areas of the eastern Philippines. But Typhoon Hagupit has veered away from the island of Cebu, located in the center of the country. This region experienced heavy rain and intense winds Sunday, but few injuries and little damage has been initially reported. Victoria Capillanes and her seven grandchildren are among the thousands of people who have sought protection in evacuation shelters set up in local schools.
From what I see, nothing is going on now, but I just wanted us to have shelter.
But many who live nearby in the poor coastal neighborhood of Barangay Ermita in Cebu City ignored government orders to evacuate. Joanne Midzon says her third-floor home offered sufficient protection.
I just trust in God, that's all.
And it was business as usual in the market area Sunday despite the rain and at times heavy winds. Shop owner Ruel Basera says no matter the weather, people still need to eat.
When there is a typhoon, I have to sell because this is where they get food from.
Forecasters say while this typhoon is not as intense as the one last year, it is still formidable. Hagupit, they warn, is a slow-moving storm that can still cause dangerous flash flooding and mudslides in mountainous regions. Brian Patton, VOA News, Cebu.
Also in the news, Syria accusing Israel of launching two airstrikes. It happened Sunday, one near the Damascus International Airport, another near the town of Demas, close to the border with Lebanon. Syrian state television said the Israeli enemy committed aggression, their words, by targeting the two areas, but said there were no casualties. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, with activists monitoring multiple battlegrounds inside of Syria, said that 10 explosions were heard outside a military base near Demas. Israel has carried out several airstrikes in Syria since the revolt against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad began. That was nearly 4 years ago, but it has not acknowledged them and did not comment on the Syrian report on Sunday. At least 70 Ethiopians drowned on the Red Sea. That happened Saturday when a migrant boat bound for Yemen capsized in rough weather, adding to what was already a record year for maritime smuggling deaths. Security officials said heavy winds and waves battered the vessel before it sank off the port of Almaka in Taiz province. In October, the UN Refugee Agency declared 2014 the most dangerous in recent memory for migrants trying to reach Yemen by water. Saturday's sinking marks the deadliest crossing of the year and brings the death toll at sea to at least 285. Tens of thousands of African migrants risk the overcrowded and unsafe voyage annually. Pakistan's security officials say a U.S. drone strike on a Taliban compound, that is, in North Waziristan, has killed at least four militants, including a wanted Syrian al-Qaeda leader and wounded two others. Military officials identified one of the dead in Sunday's strike as Umar Farooq, a key al-Qaeda figure in Pakistan. Farooq was reportedly close to the group's former leader, Osama bin Laden, and current head, Ayman al-Zawahiri. The official said Pakistan Taliban linked the commander, Hafiz Gul Bahadur, used the compound, but it was not immediately clear that is, whether Bahadur was there at the time of that strike. Other military officials in Pakistan said reports of the drone strike were not true. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are known to maintain close ties in Pakistan, and the Pakistan military has been battling militants linked to both extremist groups in North Waziristan since June. The strike came a day after Pakistani soldiers killed Al-Qaeda leader Adnan Shukri Juma, who was indicted by the U.S. for his alleged involvement in a plot to bomb New York's subway system. Departing U.S. Defense Chief Chuck Hagel has told the remaining American troops in Afghanistan that they still have challenges to meet, even as their mission soon will shift from fighting Taliban insurgents to training Afghan troops. Hagel, who recently resigned, made a final stop in Afghanistan Sunday, telling U.S. troops at a base near the eastern city of Jalalabad that the job's not over. He said the U.S. does not want to see that the tremendous progress that's been accomplished during 13 years of fighting in Afghanistan rolled back downhill, his words. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October of 2001 to overthrow the Taliban regime that harbored al-Qaeda fighters responsible for the terrorist attacks on the U.S. a month before. The U.S. and its NATO partners are withdrawing most of their troops from Afghanistan by year's end, leaving 12,500 American military personnel to train their Afghan counterparts. And at the peak of the involvement 4 years ago, about 130,000 NATO troops were deployed there. Hagel said that ultimately, no matter what the extent of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq is, people in both countries must take responsibility for their fate.
Our role is different in Iraq as it is here. In the end, each country must take the responsibility for their own future.
That is outgoing U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. Also in the news, German Chancellor Angela Merkel bitterly accusing Russia of trying to meddle with the desires of Eastern European nations to join the European Union. Ms. Merkel told Germany's Die Welt newspaper that Russia has created difficulties for Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine after they made sovereign decisions to sign agreements with the EU. She added that Russia has broken a 1994 agreement guaranteeing Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. That's a look at some of the stories making news today. There's always more right here on the Internet at voanews.com. Have a great Monday, everyone. I'm Steve Norman.
From the Voice of America, this is the International Business Report. I'm Ira Melman. Oil prices worldwide are at a five-year low, continuing to slide. What effects will this have on economies worldwide? I talked about this with Tom Closa, the global head of energy analysis for the New Jersey-based Oil Price Information Service.
I think everyone has to dismiss the notion of some prices appearing that they thought otherwise to be impossible just a few months ago. We're seeing Brent crude trade for less than $70 a barrel today, and the price of that crude was about $115 a barrel when ISIS was first becoming a known acronym in the world. So we are looking at one of the most dramatic sort of revaluations of oil prices that we've seen since the great financial unwinding and the great recession of 2008 and 9.
Is this all good news for economies and markets?
I think it's good news for the consuming countries, but for some of the big net exporters, certainly Russia, the Mideastern countries such as Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, they can handle it, but it's not good news in terms of the revenue coming in. But certainly for the emerging economies in Asia, it's very welcome news because we're looking at prices that again, are down by more than a third from where they were in June. And when you look at some of the products that kind of fuel the expansion and the movement from sort of economies of sustenance into something approaching the middle class, you're very dependent on things like jet fuel and gasoline and diesel fuel to get those economies going. And to a certain extent, the prices that we saw from 2011 to 2013 hamstrung some of the development in developing countries.
Where do you think oil prices will be a year from now?
A year from now, I think that probably we're going to be looking at prices between $50 and $70 a barrel.
Of the Oil Price Information Service here on VOA Global International Business. Coming up on VOA Global, by the way, I'm Ira Melman. Jim Stevenson has the day off. You'll be hearing American Cafe about the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks in Hawaii, and also an interesting segment from David Byrd with Now. Enjoy yourself. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. It was a surprise and unprovoked attack. On December 7, 1941, the Imperial Japanese Navy attacked the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor. Five U.S. battleships sank or were severely damaged. Several hundred warplanes were destroyed. More than 2,400 people died. Faiza Al-Masri revisits history with two new books timed to the anniversary. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Historian Craig Shirley was born more than a decade after the end of World War II. But he says the war was ever present as he grew up.
I grew up in a family and in a culture where the point of reference for everybody in conversation was before the war, during the war, or after the war. And everybody in my family had been involved directly in the war effort, whether it was civilian or military.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had resisted joining the war in Europe. He had been reelected to a third term. The nation was gradually climbing out of the Great Depression. But all that changed on December 7th, 1941, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. In his book, December 1941, 31 Days That Changed America and Saved the World, Shirley dedicates each chapter to a day, starting on December 1st. On December 8th, FDR addressed a joint session of Congress with his famous speech that began,
"Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan."
Everything stopped at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and everybody gathered around their radios in their homes, in their libraries, in their churches. The stock market closed. Everybody stopped to listen to the President of the United States.
40 minutes later, Congress declared war against Japan. On December 11th, Germany declared war on the U.S., and America joined the battle.
It was more of a, well, I guess we've got to get into this over there after all.
Going to war, Shirley says, changed America.
Women built airplanes, tanks. They learned how to become firefighters.
The nation's capital changed overnight.
Tens of thousands of civilians and military personnel come into the city. New buildings spring up every place. All the federal buildings have machine gun nests on top of them. There are Navy and Marine armed guards stationed at the entrance to every federal building in Washington, the Capitol, the White House, the State Department.
While Craig Shirley focuses mostly on what happened in the United States, another book gives an international perspective, focusing on 12 days only.
The 12 days are really pivotal in terms of the war as a whole and in the 20th century as well.
Evan Maudsley is a history professor at the University of Glasgow. He wrote December 1941, 12 days that began a world war.
In fact, the Japanese attacked the British before they attacked Pearl Harbor by about half an hour when they attacked Malaya. And the reason why they attacked Pearl Harbor is because they want to make sure the American Navy can't intervene in their invasion of Malaya.
Maudsley says the world after December 7th became fundamentally different from the world just one day before.
America as a global power, the real beginning of that, I think, does date back to the shock of Pearl Harbor. And up until this time, the whole fate of the world is determined by European powers. And from the first days of December, all of a sudden, the way the world operates has become global. You could argue, I think, that globalization almost dates back to this period of time.
For writer Faiza Al-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.
You can hear American Cafe every day on air and online at voanews.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. A new show on Broadway hopes to do for magic what Cirque du Soleil did for the circus, bring it into the 21st century. The Illusionists, Witness the Impossible, features an international group of magicians, and their illusions have left audiences stunned and amazed. The show features seven performers, including South Korea's Yoo Ho-jin, the first Asian to win the grand prize at what's known as the Olympics of Magic. Italian escape artist Andrew Basso grew up idolizing the great Harry Houdini. Basso told the Associated Press he loves the thrill of getting a dangerous trick just right.
Why I'm doing this? Well, I like the feeling, the adrenaline inside of a challenge. And there is that brief moment when you succeed in the escape that you feel more alive than any other moment.
Basso replicates one of Houdini's epic illusions in his part of the show, the water torture cell. He has to escape from a tank full of water with his hands and feet bound. But unlike Houdini, Basso's trick is done without any covers on the tank to hide how he gets out. The Italian says he has had some close calls in his career, including one where he literally got burned by his own trick.
2 years ago, I was shackled inside a wooden coffin with explosive on top, and I had 60 seconds to escape before a speedy car was coming and crushing the coffin where I was chaining. I needed around 55 seconds to escape my stuff, so I said, well, let's put the car at 60 seconds, you know? And 55, 57, 58, 59, the car is coming. I could jump out. The car crushed the coffin. I escaped, but the explosion of the explosive was 10 times bigger than the rehearsals for some unknown reasons. And the big ball of fire landed on me, and I was on fire.
Others in the spectacular show include Dan Sperry, the anti-conjurer, who mixes magic and the macabre. He's been called a mixture of Marilyn Manson and David Copperfield. Aaron Crow is known as the warrior, and he uses swords, paintball guns, and crossbows in his act to live up to that name. Adam Trent is known as the futurist, and he uses a mixture of technology and classical magic in his act.
I specialize in modern magic, a modern take on magic, presenting magic that's not been seen the way it's being presented before. So, I like doing comedy. I like to infuse music and tech-based illusions.
Trent, who idolized illusionist David Copperfield as a child, says he is looking to break the old stereotypes of magicians.
You know, magic's an interesting thing. I was definitely very shy about magic growing up. It was like this weird double life I lived as when I was in high school. I would go off, and every single weekend I was doing shows all around town in Denver, in the major city nearby. But then when I got to school, people would be like, what'd you do over the weekend? I was like, oh, nothing, just kind of sat around, because I was actually really embarrassed about what it was, because even though I knew it was a cool thing, and when I would do these shows, people, they responded amazingly, but magic definitely has this stereotype that it's had for many years now, where it's like, hey, show me a trick, and obviously as a teenager, you kind of want to blend in, I think.
Blending in is not something you'll see with this show. Other acts include Kevin James, who is one of the most prolific inventors of magical illusions, and Jeff Hobson, who's known as the trickster. The Illusionists, Witness the Impossible, has been called the world's best-selling touring magic show. For its New York run, it's playing 6 weeks at Broadway's Marquee Theater. It's produced by Simon Painter, Tim Lawson, Magic Space Entertainment, Roadshow Entertainment, and the Production Office. So do you like magic? Have you ever been to a show like The Illusionists? Let us know your story by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And remember, you can always email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. It's time for me to disappear. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
David Byrd will never disappear. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. On the way from VOA Global, Science World Express, Rick Pantaleo will tell us all about a kind of invisible shield about 11,000 kilometers above the Earth that is protecting those of us who live on this planet from what's been described as killer electrons. That's coming up all on Science World Express right here on VOA Global from the Voice of America. From the Voice of America in Washington, we check sports. Alabama, Oregon, Florida State, and Ohio State have been selected to play in the first U.S. college football playoff. Alabama is the top seed, will play number 4 Ohio State in one semifinal at the Sugar Bowl in New Orleans on New Year's Day. Oregon is the second seed and will play third-seeded Florida State in the other semifinal at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California, both of those games on New Year's Day. The winners will advance to the national championship game to be played January 12th at the home of the Dallas Cowboys in Arlington, Texas. The college football playoff is replacing the bowl championship series this season. The bowl championship series matched the two top teams in the country in a national championship game. Turn our attention to golf, a British shutout in Sun City, South Africa. Nick Dye has the story from the scene.
It's more than 2 years since Willett won a maiden victory in Germany. He'd come close on so many occasions since, including 7 top 10 finishes last season. Here, in sweltering conditions, he got off to a flying start to the final round, 3 early birdies, and he never looked back. Donald, on his 37th birthday, faltered early on, leaving Fisher as the most realistic challenger. But both take solace in the fact they were beaten by a man on top of his game, 13 under par for the weekend. Willett moves on to Leopard Creek, knowing he's into the world's top 60, and with just over $1 million in prize money from the first event on the 2015 race to Dubai.
Nick Dye reporting for us from South Africa. With temperatures rising in Australia, Australian Open organizers took another look at its extreme heat policy for next year. The last tournament was plagued by a heat wave, and many players complained about dangerous conditions. This new policy will take into account weather conditions once the temperature rises above 40 degrees Celsius. That's 104 degrees Fahrenheit. The Australian Open will also heed what's called the wet bulb global temperature, which measures humidity, wind, and temperature. It's not saying exactly right now, at least in this story, what will replace what had been and too hot. What will happen if it is too hot to play? That's a look at sports from the Voice of America in Washington.
This is Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Scientists from the University of Colorado Boulder, led by Dr. Daniel Baker, have discovered that there's kind of an invisible shield located about 11,000 kilometers above the Earth that protects those of us who live on the surface from what has been described as killer electrons. Dr. Baker tells us about those killer electrons and the invisible shield that protects us from the harmful high-energy particles.
The outer Van Allen radiation belt is filled with very high-energy electrons. By high-energy, we mean 1 million electron volts or higher. These are extremely energetic. They can penetrate through the skin of spacecraft and can embed themselves in dielectric material, for example, onboard spacecraft, such things as insulators and cables and things like that. When that happens, if the inflow of electrons is high enough, this can cause discharges within sensitive electronics. It has been known to destroy many satellites and has operational problems for many more. So that's why the name killer electrons has been coined for very high-energy electrons in the Van Allen belts. These electrons could pervade the entire region above the Earth's surface. What we've found with the Van Allen probe's mission over the last couple of years is that these very high-energy electrons come into a certain point, and that certain point is about the 11,500 kilometers above the Earth's surface from the equator, and they don't seem to go any further in. It's as if they run into an impenetrable barrier, and that's what we reported in our recent paper in Nature magazine, that time and time again we see that for periods of days, weeks, even months, that these high-energy electrons come into this special region, form a very sharp, what we would call a gradient, a very sharp boundary, and don't seem to go any further than that. It's a very puzzling phenomenon. But from the standpoint of technology, then, of course, spacecraft operating generally below that distance, below 11,000 kilometers, probably are not subjected to these very high-energy electrons much at all, whereas above that distance, there can be very copious quantities of the high-energy electrons.
Dr. Baker, from what you're saying, I'm gathering that majority of the Van Allen belts are created as a result of solar action, solar activity, such as coronal mass ejections and solar flares and such. What about things from further out in outer space, such as cosmic rays?
First of all, to reaffirm what you said, the actual acceleration of particles to high energy occurs within the Earth's magnetic field, within the Earth's magnetosphere. And so we have a cosmic accelerator of great significance, great efficiency and effectiveness operating just a few thousand miles above our head. So it's very important to remember that the accelerator is near us, but it is driven indeed by the solar forcing. This is a fascinating thing of how tightly coupled the Sun and the Earth system really are, and it takes both pieces to work effectively. But indeed, the particles coming from much more remote regions, probably accelerated at powerful shock waves associated with supernova remnants and so on, are the galactic cosmic rays. Those galactic cosmic rays penetrate into the Earth's vicinity, into our solar system, can collide with our upper atmosphere of our Earth, and there they create neutrons, spallation kind of neutrons that decay. And the decay of those neutrons having very high energy, some of those can get trapped in the Earth's magnetic field, and that seems to be what is primarily causing the inner Van Allen belt. And so that seems to be the dominant cause there. Yet another contributor to the trapped radiation around the Earth is actually very energetic particles that are produced near the Sun's surface, solar energetic particles. So in some ways, the Earth's magnetic field traps or entrains sort of whatever is flying around, and this gets caught in sort of this web around the Earth, and then this constitutes a population that we have to deal with as a technological society.
I take it then that the magnetosphere and the other aspects of our atmosphere are the elements that come into place to protect us from these harmful electrons, harmful particles coming in?
Yes, well, it's a very interesting thing that without the strong magnetic field, the kind of protective umbrella that's represented by the Earth's magnetic field, I think our planet would be a very different place. The magnetic field stands off the continual flow of hot gases from the Sun, tends to reduce substantially the high-energy particles that come from solar flares and coronal mass ejections. And so I believe that without a strong magnetic field, our atmosphere would have been strongly ablated over time. We probably wouldn't have had life develop in the way we see it today without the sort of protective layer that is represented by the magnetosphere, the Earth's magnetic field, and the atmosphere that resides above us.
That was Dr. Daniel Baker, director of the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado.
You're listening to VOA Global from the Voice of America in Washington. I'm Ira Melman. Jim Stevenson has the day off. You know, we in this country, for the most part, hold our flag, our stars and stripes, in pretty high esteem. Thus and hence this story, a bicentennial American flag that was stolen nearly 40 years ago from a park has been returned by a remorseful thief. The flag was stolen in 1976 while the Western Observatory in Manchester, New Hampshire was being repaired. Someone climbed the scaffolding and snatched the flag at night, causing an uproar in the community. The flag was recently mailed to the Manchester Historic Association from Arizona with a note of apology signed by what was called a flawed man of Manchester. That is a quote. He said, "I regretted having done this for many years and apologized for my selfishness." The thief said, "I've taken care to preserve the flag until I could return it so that it may assume its place as part of Manchester's heritage." The association hopes to keep the flag and put it on display or possibly return it to the observatory. Who knows who it was and who did this, said Jeff Barraclaw, acting director of the association, but he says, "We are just thankful to have it back." Just a reminder, you can have your free VOA 2015 calendar. Just ask for it at VOA Asia, at voanews.com. It's a beautiful calendar. You will enjoy it. It has beautiful, luscious pictures of the southwestern part of the United States. That's going to wrap up today's show. Our thanks to Director Tracy Carter, our technical director, Carl Starling, and our managing director is Diane Gao. I'm Ira Melman for Jim Stevenson. Have yourself a wonderful start of the new week. Talk to you tomorrow.